Accession number 4549, Reel 2.
Mr. Viles, Reel 2. How did you actually become a carpenter rigger then at Halton?
Well, according to the order of merit on the examination list, when you first entered and you went to Halton, the allocation was so many, the top passers in the examination were offered signals work, like radio and wireless. And they went to Flowerdown for their apprenticeship, or if that was the station for signals. And then came the aircraft engine fitters. They were the second elite. And from those branched off the motor transport fitters, the sheet metal workers, the pattern makers, and last of all came, the last 150 were riggers. In other words, what they thought, we were the dentists of the 500.
And so when you first went into Halton, all the boys were doing the same course, were they?
No. Each boy, if he was a fitter, an engine fitter, he would be filing steel into different shapes that they wanted making. If he was a pattern maker, you'd be doing the same, or a sheet metal worker, or an armourer. All those, they were the first year of their apprenticeship was nothing else but cutting out, filing, and making different shapes that they required, like dovetails. Anything that they required making, and it had to fit so the joints didn't show. Because if they did show and there was a gap, they'd measure that gap, and for every so much, you lost a mark off it. The same as with the carpenter rigger. Every time he was a 16th of an inch or so near that out, he would lose a mark off his job.
How did the boys in the different crafts get on with each other? Was there any rivalry?
No rivalry at all. We all got along splendidly. Of course, each entry got on with itself better than what they got on with the other entries, because they're either senior to them or junior. But nevertheless, there was no great rivalry between the entries or the squadrons, only between the wings. And when it came to inter-squadron rivalry in sports, of course, there was a great rivalry there. There was a great rivalry in the inter-wing sports. And there was a greater rivalry when we first went as a station, apprentice wing, in all the interstation sports, and won everything practically.
Did sport play a big part in the lives at Halton?
A very great part. Every Saturday was devoted to sport. Saturday morning, you won't believe this, but Saturday morning we spent 4 hours with a bucket picking up pebbles off a huge area they were clearing for a sports pitch they were going to build. And then in the afternoon, you could play football, you could play any sport that you could name. We had a beautiful swimming pool there for swimming. We had a gymnasium, first class, and we had beautiful football pitches, rugby pitches, hockey pitches, gymnastic, everything you could name in the sport line we had. And everyone, maybe one in an entry didn't do any sport, maybe a couple. But sport was a great thing here, and it was looked upon. If you were a great sportsman, you were sitting pretty. For example, D.O. Finlay, the hurdler. I'm not going to tell you now, because if it's going on record, I'm not going to tell you what happened, but he wasn't very good on his passing out exam. But he'd just broken the RAF record as an aircraft apprentice hurdler. And he eventually passed out an AC2. He was posted to Tangmere, and he got his AC1 as soon as he got there on the next trade test board, then his LAC, and was sent to Sergeant Pilot's course. He became a Sergeant Pilot, and in no time he was offered a commission, and he wound up Group Captain. He's dead now.
Was sport compulsory?
No. Not any particular sport, but you had to partake in some sport or other. It was essential to keep you fit. And I agreed with that all down the line, because I was a great sportsman myself.
Why did you agree with it?
Well, I think it brought everyone together, whether you were in one wing or in two wing or in A, B or C squadrons. It brought you in closer contact, and you had different points of view about it, and you talked them over. There was great rivalry about it, which is great fun too, especially the boxing, when everyone was there. And the shouting and the cheering that went on there, well, it was just fantastic. It wasn't that they wanted to see someone knocked about badly or knocked out. It was to see their man just to win, that was all, whether it was points or otherwise.
Was there much ragging?
Yes, there was quite a bit of ragging, but it was very, I would say, friendly ragging. It wasn't nasty ragging like you get today at these football matches and things like that, where somebody has got a bottle behind his back, something like that. No one would ever think of doing a thing like that or punching someone in the crowd. They'd scruff his hair around, yes, and laugh at it, but that was part of it, I think. There was a great comradeship. In fact, the finest comradeship I ever knew. In fact, better, I think, than in the outside in the men's service until the war came along. And, of course, that was the greatest comradeship.
What was the standard of instruction like?
First class, absolutely. Every instructor there was a corporal or senior NCO. And when you realize that to become a corporal in those days, you were an LAC for anything from 8 to 14 years before you were made a corporal. And you were doing practical work all the time, so you had an insight to everything in your particular trade. And then they became sergeants and flight sergeants according to their ability. And so we had the best. They picked the best for us. No doubt about that.
Were the instructors popular? Were the instructors popular with the boys?
In most cases, yes. You had the odd one who wasn't liked because he was, what can I say now? He would approach you wrong. He didn't approach you in the right way. He was treating you like a child instead of a growing youth. And instead of talking to you, he was talking at you. If you can understand what I'm trying to say. And there's a difference in the two. When you're talking to a person, you're dictating to him. When you're talking to him, you're trying to get along with him and see both sides of you and see what you can do or can't do. And there's a vast difference in those two, I think.
What type of schooling did you get? You mentioned the schooling for the Oxford and
first
Cambridge.
Class, we had first class schooling, absolutely. We had our masters there were all master MAs, BAs, or in one case, two cases, there were professors, I think. Yes. One was the math one and the others was the science one. And our youngest math master was an ex-flying officer who'd been badly burned in a crash. And he was discharged from the Air Force and he became one of the masters at Halton as a civilian, Kermode. And he became the chief educational officer of the Royal Air Force as an Air Vice Marshal. And he lived down the road from where I lived when I was posted to Biddle Wallop. He died, I think, about 5 years ago. He was a brilliant man. I had my first master. I reckon that was my strongest subject, best subject. My first master, I didn't learn a thing off him in 6 months. And he had letters galore after his name. Kermode came along. He was an M.A. mess. And in 6 months more, I picked up that 6 months and got up in line with the rest. He could impart his knowledge to you. He had the most wonderful art of imparting what he knew and what he wanted you to know and getting you to grasp it in the most simple and enlightening ways that you didn't realize he was doing it.
Did the boys have much free time?
Oh, when you say free time, Wednesday afternoon, of course, was sports afternoon, always. Saturday afternoon was sports. And if you hadn't been on a charge for a month, you were allowed a 48-hour pass once a month.
But you never got one of those?
I never got one.
So you really didn't have any free time at all?
Yes, I could go out on a Saturday evening until 9 o'clock. And I had to be back in at 9 o'clock for roll call and lights out at 9:30. And I could go out all day Sunday after church parade.
What would you do with that spare time?
Go out walking. If you had a girlfriend, go out with a girlfriend. I never had a girlfriend. I hadn't got time for them. But I spent most of my time either in the swimming pool or in the gymnasium or in the boxing ring.
Have you got any particular memories of the air officer commanding at Halton?
Yes, I remember one day walking past the airfield with an apprentice friend of mine, and an old boy came walking along, and we thought he was a local farm man or could have been a hobo or tramp. And we just walked past him, and the next thing we knew, we were called back by him, and he said, "Do you know who I am?" And I said, "No, I don't know who you are." He said, "Well, I'm your Air Officer Commander, Air Vice Marshal Lamb." And we immediately sprung to attention and saluted him and apologized. But that didn't stop us being on the report.
What happened?
We were given a thorough good talking to, and to make sure to keep our eyes open in the future.
When did you leave Halton?
December 1927.
How did that come about?
Well, we had taken all our exams in the previous October and November, both in our particular trades and at school, and had successfully passed out different ranks. I was successful, as I mentioned before, in passing out an aircraft in first class, and I was posted to the cadet college at Cranwell. I reported straight there on December the 19th. I reported at Cranwell, and I was given a pass and told to go on 14 days leave, Christmas leave, and report back after that.
Was Cranwell very different from Halton?
Yes, entirely different. We had these beautiful stone blocks where we all lived at Halton, three stories high and double width with a centre staircase. At Cranwell, we had single blocks there, but they were very nice. But the poor cadets, who were the elite of the Air Force, they had the 1914 wooden huts to live in. And they were right opposite the hospital there. And where the present college is today, the stone-built college, the new college, as I call it, used to be the sports pitch. There was no college there as such when I was there. All just the wooden huts and their classrooms and their workrooms, etc.
And did the food improve there?
Yes, the food did improve a little, but not to any great extent. It was if they hadn't got a frying pan in the Air Force, I'm sure half the Air Force would have starved.
And what did your work involve there?
My first occupation there was in the aero repair shop under Flight Lieutenant Noon, who was never sober, to my knowledge. And he was an Irishman. And as far as I know, he didn't know much about his job either. But we had a very good warrant officer there, a warrant officer second class, and he was quite good, and he helped us along, and he put us under corporals and sergeants, the case may be. When the aircraft came in for a complete overhaul, we had to do the job there. The other inspections were done on the flight sites by the NCOs and airmen concerned, like 20-hour, 40-hour, 60-hour. Then when the 120-hour complete overhaul came, we took it into our section.
What type of work would the overhaul involve?
That meant complete stripping down, fabric, inspection of all the framework and all the controls, that is the cable controls, and anything that had to be repaired, we did it, made it by hand and put them in, back in, and complete the job. And then the fabric workers would come back and refabric it and paint it with dope.
What type of things would you make by hand?
Any ribs that might be fractured, any of the framework that might be fractured, the fuselage or the rudder or the fin, tailplane, main planes, anywhere, undercarriage, whatever. If there's anything broken, we would take that section out or part out and remake it with spruce. Canadian spruce was the wood we used.
What type of planes were you working on?
At that time, at Cranwell, we had de Havilland 9-8 from the First World War, Bristol fighters in the First World War, Avro 504K, that was with the French monorail engine in, where the whole engine went round with the propeller, five cylinders, and all the whole lot went round with the propeller on a main shaft, which was secured to a back plate. So if you crashed and you couldn't get out, the shaft went straight to the back plate and straight to the pilot.
Did that ever happen to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge. I never saw a 504 crash in my life. I always thought it was one of the safest aircraft we ever had.
Why was that?
I don't know why, but they were so easy to handle and so maneuverable, and they were pretty well built as well. They were made by Avros, the actual aircraft, although the first engine was a monorail engine. The next one we had in was Armstrong Siddeley 600 job, that with overhead valves on. And that was a stationary engine, air-cooled engine, in a circle. And then the Siskins came in, and the Bulldogs, Bristol Bulldogs and Armstrong Siddeley Siskins. At that time, we had Whittles there, the inventor of the jet engine. He was a cadet there then, and I remember him coming back. We just had the Siskins in. He was in his senior year there then, and he was very famous for his aerobatics. And our flight commander, A.B. Russell, was a bit of a tartar on clean aircraft. And, of course, we used pure castor oil then. Stink to high heaven. And he had gone up doing aerobatics and come back, and the aircraft was plastered with this castor oil from end to end. And he called Whittles over, and he said, have you just flown that aircraft, Whittles? He said, yes, sir. He said, right, go and get yourself a bucket of water, hot water, a scrubbing brush, Sergeant Major's soap and a swab, and I want that cleaning down and polished before you get back to it, before you leave here. And he had to do it. We had Whittles, Lord David Douglas Hamilton, and my own four from my entry. Giles, who was later almost killed in a 9-8 when it crashed and went up in flames. McKechnie, who pulled him out and got an OB for that, or an MB or something for that, pulled him out. And Giles later became the senior stores officer for the RAF as an air marshal. There was Giles, McKechnie, and Earl, who was with me on 55 Squadron and went out on the boat with me as a pilot officer. And I could never remember the name of the fourth fellow. Those are three of them, anyway, of my entry that were with there with Whittle and Lord David Douglas Hamilton. And they were a right roaring crowd, they were, too.
In what way?
Oh, they were always out at night. They used to go out in their cars and come back flying with booze. Absolutely, as wild as cuckoos.
Was discipline less strict at Cranwell?
For the cadets, yes, and it was a little less strict for us, definitely. There was no argument about that, but it was still strict. Of course, they had the police there. They used to change the police around, and they used to come up from Holton. And maybe the ones at Cranwell would go back for to the police depot. It was a police depot at Halton for another year of refresher. And of course, the ones that came up then knew all of us boys, and they knew what my reputation was, and they jumped on me straight away. And I was only there for a year, and I'd done 115 days confined to camp, because they just didn't like my face. And for the first time in my life, I put in a redress grievance, and I was posted. I asked for a posting, and my wing commander posted me on those grounds, and I got posted 15 miles down the road to Spittlegate, Grantham.
What was this redress of grievance?
That the police were always after me. No matter what I did or where I went, they were after me all the time. And out of that 115 days that I got, 104 were police charges.
So this was... can you describe what a redress of grievance was? What did it look like?
My redress of grievance was I put a complaint in to my flight commander that I was being harassed by the police every day and everywhere I went. And they would charge me on the least thing, the least compunction they could get me on, they would have me. And they did. No argument about it.
Was this a special form that you filled in, or was it just a letter you drafted?
No, just a letter I drafted out to my flight commander. And he sent it to my station commander, Wing Commander Evils, and he had me up before him. And he said, and he asked me what made me think they were after him. And I said, well, you've only got to look at my record at Cranwell, sir. And I said, I've got...
At Halton?
No, at Cranwell, this was. I said, I've been here just on a year now, or almost just on a year. I forget, it was just over under. I said, and I've done 115 days confined to camp. I said, and 104 of those, I said, are police charges. I said, I think that speaks for itself. So he got my record out, and he did a quick check through them. And he said, all right. He said, I'll grant your request. He said, you'll be posted within the next 3 days. And I was posted the day after. And I went 50 miles down the road to Spittlegate. And who should I run into there but my old flight sergeant of police, who was in charge of the detention barracks at Halton, McQuillan. And the boys had already fixed his new motorbike up there. He was so hated... Halton, and he just bought a brand new Zenith motorbike with a sidecar on, and he just run it in beautifully. It's a beautiful thing, and somebody put a couple of pounds of sugar in his petrol tank. No one ever knew who did it. Didn't do it, I can assure you that.
Did that make any difference to the way in which he behaved afterwards?
Oh, he was a terror on apprentices. Wherever he went, he was after apprentices. Always. That stuck in his goal.
But the sugar incident didn't affect his behaviour?
No, it made him worse with apprentices. Absolutely.
And how did Spittlegate compare with Cranwell?
It would have been very nice, but for the station adjutant, who belonged to... He was the son of one of the famous clothing people in England. I forget the name of them now. And... he was a bit of a terror. He was only a flying officer, the station agent, and the station commander was a wing commander. And he was always instigating red tape of his own. For instance, when we were allowed to wear civil clothes, we couldn't wear them until we'd gone on parade on the march on the square and laid out our civilian clothes for him to inspect. And we had a corporal there who'd come into a lot of money from one of his family. And he had all his clothes laid out from tails, evening dress, right down to plus four for playing golf. About 20 or 30 suits laid out. He had a beautiful sports car and everything. And when he came up and he said, you can't wear this, he said, that's better off than the officers. No, he said, you're not allowed to wear civilian clothes. And the corporal put a redress grievance in. And he went down and saw the AOC. He was... just down the bottom of the hill, 38 Group, our training command AOC, Gilbert de la Ferte. He was an Air Vice Marshal. And he put a complaint in about this, and he was granted permission to wear civilian clothes. And I used to sleep next door to a VC, MacDonald, First World War Army man. And he was drunk one night, He got into an argument. There was an argument as to who could drink the most beer, him or Corporal Brown. So they had it out in the canteen one night. And MacDonald lost. He pulled out, with it running out of his ears nearly, after 28 bottles. Brown went on and drank 33 bottles between 6 and 10 o'clock. And that was the night I got him to show me the only time I saw his VC, the only one I've ever seen to have it on my hand. And it's only because I was drunk that he showed it to me.
Were the First World War veterans much respected in those days?
I wouldn't pass a verdict on that, because most of the veterans were NCOs, and as far as we were concerned, NCOs were our enemies. There's no argument about that. They were just our enemies. We couldn't get along with them. There were one here and one there. Now, my sergeant at Spitalgate, I got along with him fine. He was a very, very good NCO. He understood his men. He adapted himself to his men. And he got the best out of them, always. And he had the best flight on the station. No argument about that. But you very rarely got a sergeant like that. Very rarely. But he was commissioned later on. He retired as an Air Vice Marshal.
What were your duties at Spitalgate?
Well, when I was at Cranwell, first of all, when I left there after a year, and I became I went there after a year at the overhaul hangars, I got posted to flights then. I got posted, as I said, to Whittle's flight. Well, when I went to Cranwell, to Spitalgate, I was posted, first of all, to the aero repair shed there, doing the same kind of work that I'd done at Cranwell. And I did that for about 3 months. And I've been applying all the time for overseas service. I wanted to get overseas. I wanted to see as much of the world as I could. And everyone thought I was mad, because no one wanted to go overseas except me. And yet I kept getting thrown out, this application. But when I got to Spitalgate, and I got posted then from the air repair shops to A flight on the new Avro trainer and the Tomtits, Hawker Tomtits. And they had slots in the wings, and everybody was trying to do an inverted loop in these. And my pilot, Flying Officer Flowers, in 1929, he took me down to see the Snyder Trophy race. He was going down there at Gosport. We were stationed at Gosport, and we went and saw the Snyder Trophy race. He eventually inverted loop to Tomtit, and I was with him on the day he did it. He frightened the life out of me. Well, he always did frighten the life out of me trying to do this, because I always thought he'd get to a stall and start spinning and rip off the slots, and we wouldn't get out of it. But he was a good pilot, and he did it eventually.
What did you think of the Schneider Trophy race?
It was the most absorbing thing I think I've ever seen. During that period of my life, anyway. It was fantastic. And that was the day that Batchley brothers had smashed the world record flying, but he lost the race. They said he'd cut the last pylon. He never did, you know, because I was sitting over the last pylon practically with the glasses. And he was well outside it. But we'd already won it then off the Italians for the second time. And I don't know whether they thought he pushed the aircraft too much or what, but he'd broken the record. He'd broken our previous better man. I think his name was Boothman, if I remember rightly. Flight Lieutenant Boothman. Webster, my flight commander in Iraq, he was the first one in 27 as a flying officer at the Lido in Italy. Boothman was the second, yes. And then the last one was a flight lieutenant Longsoming, and he was killed during the war in 31, he won it. And that was the last time it was raced for. It became our property.
Coming back to the work that you were doing at Cranwell and Spitalgate, did the ground crews have any particular aircraft which was their favourite?
I think everyone liked the old Avro. We had then, in the Avro 504K had gone out with a monorail engine in. They brought it back in as the 504N with the Armstrong Siddeley engine in, fixed engine. And I think that was everyone's favorite. It was so simple to work on. The things were, everyone, except when the new Avro trainer came in after the Tomtit, right after the Tomtit, where we could take the panels away by just unscrewing little insert screws, and the whole panel would come away without having to take all the fabric off from underneath by undoing the lacing and all that and doing it up again.